This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Doc Henley used to tend bar and play music in nightclubs, but in 2003, he started thinking of other ways to spend his life, and he came up with an idea that has literally changed his life and the lives of many, many others. He founded an organization called Wine to Water, the goal of which is to quench the thirst of the needy. And by needy, we're talking about people in the most desperate situations of any on the planet. His quest has taken him to some of the world's most impoverished and unhealthy places to dig wells and teach villagers about maintaining clean water supplies. He's also had time to write a book about his experiences, also called Wine to Water. And Doc Henley joins us once again to share some of what he's taught to others and what he himself has learned. He joins us from the studios of WUNC in Durham. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks so much for having me again, Mike.
I should say welcome back. Last time we got to talk in person, and this time you're far away, but that's okay. For those folks who may have missed our first conversation, I got to tell you, we heard so much about that conversation for so long. People were so impressed with your efforts to help others around the world find water. But a lot of people missed that conversation. So tell us again how you went from being this fun-loving bartender, Harley Davidson riding, carefree guy to a person serious about making difference in the world.
Well, I tell you, I was in Raleigh, a bartender downtown at this Hibernian Irish pub, you know, on Glenwood Avenue, and I had about a semester left of school at NC State University, and I was getting a degree in communications. Now, to be honest with you, I got to back up a little bit and let you know that my communications degree, the only reason why I took that is when I went through, when you meet your advisor, she actually made the mistake of breaking down like the gender ratio of each major. Mm-hmm. And apparently communications was like 80% women. So I was like, oh, my goodness, that's the major that I need to study. So anyway, I'm in a major that I'm not even really sure really what it is yet, and I'm getting ready to graduate with it. and so I actually took some time this Christmas break, 2003, to just get away and look at my life. You know, I'm playing music out, I'm bartending, I'm getting ready to get a degree at NC State, and I'm like, you know, what am I doing with myself? And I pulled back. My parents were in Boone, North Carolina at the time, and I went home to kind of just take some time, and I woke up middle of the night one night with this phrase, Wine to Water, stuck in my head. And wow. I was a little freaked out at first because that doesn't really happen to me all that much. So I grabbed a pad and paper that was next to the bed, and I jotted it down. And honestly, I was thinking, you know, maybe this is a cool idea for a song. You know, I write some music. And so I wrote it down on the paper, and I stared at it on the pad, and I just knew it was more than just a song. I looked at it, and I'm like, am I supposed to know something here? You know, and I looked at the word wine, and I'm like, well, I know plenty about that. I'm a bartender, but I know nothing about water. And so I was just kind of getting used to using, like, the Internet and Google at the time. And so I went downstairs to their computer, typed in water issues, water problems, whatever, and I was shocked at what I was getting ready to find out, that more children in our world die from unclean drinking water than absolutely anything else. At the time, it was 1.1 billion people didn't have access to clean drinking water, and I was shocked. I stayed up that entire night reading and researching how bad this problem is, but worse, that not many people knew anything about it or were doing anything about it. And so that's when those words kind of made sense to me, and I filled up that rest of that pad instead of with some country song. I ended up filling it out with the concept of an organization that would utilize the bar crowd that I was already in and the service industry and figure out a way to help solve this world's water crisis just using the tools and resources that I had around me as a bartender.
Thinking back, had you ever thought about this before that night? Had you seen a documentary perhaps that maybe planted a seed in the back of your brain? I mean, where do you think this wine to water phrase came from in the middle of the night out of a dead sleep?
You know, I don't really know for sure. I definitely, growing up, always had a heart for some type of service. My old man was a preacher man growing up, and one of the things that really sat well with me as a child and as I got older was the, you know, he tried to teach us a lot of things, but the one thing that really sunk in was giving. He always wanted us to, you know, growing up, we get to go serve the homeless and feed at soup kitchens, and you know, he would make us at different times of the year give gifts to people that aren't quite as fortunate, and so that was something I always enjoyed because that made sense to me. So I always had that, I think, in me that it was something then that I enjoyed and maybe wanted to do. But specifically the water crisis, I had no clue. I had never heard about it or thought about it. And I think there may have been something that sparked that interest, though. It's just, within a day or two earlier of me having that night, I ended up meeting one of my mother's friends in Boone, whose husband worked for the international aid organization Samaritan's Purse. And mm-hmm. So I'd heard some stories about, this guy and the work that he had been able to do and how many lives all over the world he's been able to reach doing all different types of work. So maybe there was that little seed planted from meeting that person that kind of got my wheels turning, But I'm really not sure where exactly it came from.
We'll talk about this in depth as we go through the program, but I'm just curious, after that night of research on the internet, finding out all these facts and figures about people who die from lack of access to clean water, and in fact, lack of access to any water in some situations.
Right.
When you had boots on the ground, when you finally went on that first mission or those first several missions to help people get access to water and teach them how to clean water, was the picture that you had in your head from reading anything like what you actually saw when you got there?
Night and day different, because when I was back home after the very first event that I held, which ended up being a few months later in February of 2004, until I actually took off on a plane headed for Darfur, Sudan, there was about a 6 month time period there, and I remember researching when I knew that Darfur was where I was going to go. I remember researching Darfur and looking at images online and seeing pictures of women and children walking to get water, or seeing the picture of sub-Saharan Africa. Sometimes 120, 130 degree temperatures, and you could just see on the screen, it almost looks uninhabitable. And I remember looking at this from the U.S., looking at this like, how am I going to live here? Like, I don't know how I can survive in a place like that. And then you see all these pictures of these rebels and these men called the Janjaweed that carrying all these weapons, and you're like, I'm getting ready to go there, And then when I got there, There's nothing that can do a picture justice. No amount of descriptions of climate and temperature can prepare you for walking off of a little, two prop plane that then you step out and all of a sudden this desert heat just hits you in the face, and then you realize I'm going to be in this for a year, and there's nothing that can prepare you for that and for what happens when you go to your first refugee camp with 10,000 people living on top of each other that have no access to anything. But the thing is that what was shocking to me is how quickly I was able to adapt. And I don't think it was just me. I think that human beings are very resilient. And what I began to see when I was there is that these people aren't just someone on a screen. And it was hard for me to relate to them on a screen because they were opposite of me in every way. These are black African tribal people in Darfur that are Muslim. And I'm a white Christian guy from the South in the States. So there couldn't be any more opposite. But when I got there, I realized these people are human beings. And when you meet these rebel soldiers and you're working with them, they're fathers and husbands, just like me. They eat, they laugh, they drink coffee, they have fun. And that was what really made it easy for me to really entrench myself in that culture, was just seeing the humanity of these people and that they're struggling and they're hurting. And instead of looking at them as Darfuris or as Africans or as Muslims, I just was able to very quickly just see them as men and women and children that need help.
Doc Henley is our guest. He's the founder of Wine to Water and the author of a book of the same name, Wine to Water, A Bartender's Quest to Bring Clean Water to the World. He was our guest several years ago here when he was passing through Charlotte. And as I mentioned, we got a lot of reaction from people who were really impressed not only with what you were actually doing, what you were actually accomplishing, but the way you accomplished it, going from being a bartender to starting this 501c3 nonprofit aid organization called Wine to Water, which has raised so much money when you come to think of it from its startup to where you are today. How did it begin? It just began with what? Wine tastings in the bar that people paid money to come to, and then the money went to help people? Is that how it started?
Yeah, the first event, I had a great friend of mine, Tasha Sullivan from Raleigh. She helped me get some wine. She had a contact in the wine world, and she was also bartending with me. So we had free wine that came. We had a free music from yours truly here. And then we had a DJ come later on for the late night crowd that offered his time. And we had the place for free. And we had some hors d'oeuvres. And so everything was free. And the first one was like a pay at the door kind of thing. And they paid. And then I had a chance for people to give that night. We raised like $6,000. And I'd never been to a fundraiser, much less put one on myself. And so, but it took me about a month and a half to pull it together. We raised about $6,000, and then within a month after that, there was a restaurant owner that came to that event that wanted to do another event at their restaurant, so we did another one. Another $5,000 or $6,000 came in, and then opened a P.O. box, and people started sending in checks just saying, hey, couldn't make it to your event, but love what you're starting to do now. Here's some money. So before I knew it, I'm sitting on, you know, a decent amount of cash, like $10,000, $20,000, and had no idea what I was supposed to do with it.
Well, I'm glad you're an honest man, because you could have gone out and had a nice time with that money. but you didn't know what you were going to do with it. So I'm curious about how it got from a wine to water wine tasting to raise money for helping people with water to you actually being the guy in the location, digging the wells, teaching people how to have clean water. How did that happen? How did you decide to do it yourself?
I didn't actually, in the beginning, have the intention of being the one that went over. I was happy just to continue bartending and playing music and raising the money. And I decided that it would be best just to give it to an established organization that's already doing great work. So I did a lot of research. I found that same organization where I'd already met the person, Samaritan's Purse, based out of Boone. They have phenomenal projects around the world. One of the things that really stuck out to me was their over 90% of their money was going to programs. And I did some more research and found out just so many amazing things. So I went to give that money away to them. And the guy that I was meeting with, his name was Kenny Isaacs. He's over all the international projects. I went to just kind of ask him a few questions and ask if I can give my money all just to water projects. And he kind of flipped that talk around. And he's like, why are you doing this? And I said, you know, I really don't know. Something happened to me a couple months ago, and I'm really enjoying being a part of something bigger than myself. So if it's okay, I'm just going to keep raising money, and I'm gonna keep funneling that money to your water projects. And by the end of that meeting, he said, I tell you what, why don't you keep your money? How about you come work for me, and I'll send you anywhere in the world you want to go, and you bring that money with you and support the projects that you want to support. And then down the road, you'll have the training that you need in the field, and it seems like you already know how to raise the money. You could put those two together and continue creating your organization.
Wow.
So that's what gave me my start, and he ended up sending me off to Darfur.
Now,
so.
Yeah, were you married at the time?
I wasn't. So it made it a little easier to go to Darfur and kind of be a little bit of a reckless cowboy on the desert.
Yeah, because you are married now, and you have a little boy, right?
I have two. I have about 3.5 and 1.5 right now.
And we're going to talk about this because we're almost out of time in this segment. We're going to talk about this later. But you go to some of the most dangerous places in the world with this. How does your wife feel about that? How do you feel about that with two little boys at home?
It's tougher. It's much tougher than it used to be for me. There's an element of fear there that I've never, ever had before. Because when you're only caring for yourself, you know, you can kind of be a little reckless, but when you're worried about two little children that you love more dearly than anything on the planet and this wife that's just absolutely amazing, and you worry about not being able to wake up next to them every morning, that's a scary thought.
Doc Henley is our guest, the founder of Wine to Water and the author of a book of the same name. We're going to talk about where this quest to bring clean water and to quench the thirst of the needy around the world has taken him and into what situations, very precarious situations in some cases, has taken him when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Doc Henley is back with us again after a several-year absence. He's been busy in that time. Founder of Wine to Water. He's become a CNN hero. He's the author of a book of the same name, Wine to Water, A Bartender's Quest to Bring Clean Water to the World. A fascinating story, some of which you will hear as we go through this hour. The CNN hero, I'm not sure they're still doing this. I guess they are, but they were picking out people periodically to salute on the air around the world. What did that do for you in terms of your fundraising efforts?
That was an absolute, a huge leg up for our organization. Up through 2008, obviously everyone knows that was a difficult time for our country and the world, and especially for small, grassroots nonprofits. we rely on people's generosity and their giving, and in such a, you know, economic dire straits time, it's tough for little organizations. So I remember throughout 2008, there were times when I would look at our bank account and it would get down to like $12. and I've always told myself when I started this that if I ever went into debt with it, if it ever went below zero, then that was it. Then you know, well, maybe it wasn't meant to be. And so I was getting really nervous a lot throughout 2008 and just trying to be more busy and get out and spread the word of how we work and how it's different and why, you know, people would want to support our organization. And then I get a phone call in February 2009 from someone in the CNN Heroes department. And honestly, I thought it was a joke. I thought one of my friends was, you know, pulling my leg or something, calling me saying, I'm from CNN and, you know, you've been nominated. And I ended up talking with this lady, though, for a couple hours, and she was asking me all these questions about these stories in the field, and was this true? Did this happen? This happen? And after I was getting done talking with her, I'm like, well, why did you call me? How did this happen? And she kind of seemed a little surprised. She said, you don't know? And I'm like, well, no, I don't have any idea. She said, well, one of your friends, let me look here. And she, you know, fumbled through some papers and said, it looks like a Tasha Sullivan from Raleigh has nominated you to be a CNN hero, and which was a friend of mine that helped me start the organization and continued to bartend after I had left Raleigh, and that was really cool. And I had to go through 3 months of really heavy vetting. They looked at all our bank accounts and everything in and out, and then we got I guess in April I made it to the CNN Heroes for the year, which is about 30 plus, and then it goes to a panel of judges of. I think our year was Colin Powell and Sir Elton John, Whoopi Goldberg, Shakira. There was a decent amount of celebrity judges that are also philanthropists that vote on their top 10. And we made it to that top 10 in October of 2009. And that changed everything for us. You know, being able to get up on that stage and that led to an interview with Larry King and Anderson Cooper. And I think up until that year, end of 2009, that 5 years of working, we had took us 5 years to reach 25,000 people around the world in four different countries. And in 1 year following that, in 2010, we doubled it to reach 50,000 people. And we were in nine different countries at that point. And then just last year, we've been able to come close to doubling it again. We're hovering right around the 100,000 person mark beneficiary wise. And we're about 12 different countries now around the world. So it really... Gosh, it gave us a voice when before we didn't really have a voice. And that's why, you know, media and PR, that stuff is so important, but it's also something that you can't plan for and you can't buy as a small nonprofit. You know, right. You just can't afford it.
Well, let's talk about some of the places that you have been and where you've lent a helping hand. And I don't mean to be flippant about this when I say you got your feet wet. in Darfur. You started in Darfur. Is that because Samaritan's Purse had a group, an organization on the ground there, and they sent you there, or did you choose Darfur in some way?
Samaritan's Purse has they have programs all over the world, and when I was in that meeting with Mr. Isaacs, he asked me, you know, where would you like to go? And I thought for a little bit, and I said, you know, I don't really know much about the world. I'm a communications major. I don't know much about what all's going on and where the biggest need is, but I just asked that you would send me to the worst place that you know of. and a lot of people think I was being, like, courageous or something, and I always tell people that, no, it's not that I was, like, being, you know, bold and adventurous and courageous. I was actually, my thought process is, like, I don't really consider myself the most intelligent person in the world, so if I go to the worst place in the world, I'm pretty sure I could have a decent impact in the worst place. And so he said, all right, well, it looks like that's going to be either Afghanistan or Darfur. And so he broke them both down for me and told me the pros and cons. And he said the catch is Afghanistan, and we've got a team there and they've been there for a while. But Darfur is really just now starting to erupt. This is, you know, early 2004. And the genocide is just now starting to unfold there, and we don't have anyone on the ground. And so I'm like, okay, genocide, sub-Saharan Africa, nobody on the ground. Yeah, that's the one. Send me there.
And the genocide was being conducted by the Janjaweed, these rebel troops supported by the government, and they used water as a weapon, didn't they?
They did, and that's what's crazy. It's such an effective weapon, and the thing is they're doing it so sneakily now to where it doesn't really get pinned on the government anymore. In the beginning, and even when I was there, it was very blunt. They would go around, and I would go around and try to fix wells that they had literally shot up with their 50 caliber machine guns, you know, and just to destroy the water systems and make people leave this area. And then they would also, in the open wells, you know, after they had done got done killing some people in a village, they would dump the corpses down in the open wells to pollute the groundwater system. And so they were doing things very open and blatant at that time. But even now, they could still use water as a weapon by making these people live. And one of the camps is nearly 100,000 people, Calma Camp right outside of Niala. And one of the ones I worked in is about, 10,000 people in about 1 kilometer square radius. And it's unbelievable. I mean, you're walking 4 or 5 hours outside of that camp to get water, and still, when you're living in those situations, you know that's what you're doing. You're starving people of that most precious resource, and so now sneakily they've figured out a way that they can you know pollute water supplies, they can make unsanitary conditions, and it's not getting tagged to the government for doing that anymore. And so it's a sad thing, but it's their most, by far, their most effective weapon.
Is that still going on?
It definitely is. And the sad thing is no one ever hears about those things, and Darfur is not a hot topic anymore. And people, you know, we move on from one thing to the next to the next, and we've long gone, moved from Darfur. That's why people ask me, do you think it's going to get better? And sometimes I say, you know, I don't know because the world seems to have forgotten Darfur.
Wow, you didn't know anything about raising money, and you became pretty successful at it. I would think that since you woke up in the middle of the night with this idea of wine to water, you didn't know anything about how to build a well or how to clean water supplies that were in need of cleaning. How did you learn that? Because you found yourself over there needing to build wells. How did you know what to do?
That's a great question. I think I do what I've always done in every situation in my life, whether it's in the field or whether it's growing this organization from scratch or whatever it is. I always try to surround myself with people that know more than I do. And so when I got on the ground there, my first few hires of local guys, they were hand pump technicians. They knew how to break down wells and take them apart and put them together. And I quickly noticed that I don't have access to millions and millions of dollars like some of the bigger organizations did. And have their own drill rigs and all this kind of stuff. I was starting a program from scratch and using a lot of just the money that I had raised, in the bars. And so I couldn't go around and drill, you know, wells at, you know, $7,000 to $10,000 a pop at that, you know, in this area. But I could fix broken wells because I noticed in the desert that there were, you know, over 60% of the wells in all of sub-Saharan Africa are just in non-working order. So me and my guys started traveling around and looking and seeing what we could do. And I was so shocked every time I would pull up a well that was broken and see that the bottom pump, it was wet. Because the people around would say, oh, that well had dried up. They just didn't know that there was a small piece that was broken or missing. So we would go in and fix that and take care of it for them. And it was $40, $50 fix sometimes. And so that was really... really shocking to me that we could have the same impact as a $10,000 well with $50.
If you're hiring local people to help you do what you don't know how to do, why didn't they know how to do that? Why didn't they do it on their own?
Well, the guys that I brought on were based in this area, Niala, and they had training from probably some other NGO, but not these people aren't out in the field. Once you get out in the field in these villages in the desert, they haven't been trained or taught anything. And that was another thing that was shocking to me. So after we started fixing these wells, I started scratching my head thinking, well, wait a minute, they're just going to be at the same boat that they're in before. I'm going to leave one day and my guys may not always be here. And then they're going to have a broken well again on their hands in 3 or 4 years. So what we started doing is taking toolkits with us to these different villages around the desert and then training some community leaders that are in these villages to teach them how to take apart their wells and how to fix them and then leave them with the tools necessary to do so. And that was really, I feel like, my biggest accomplishment, and it came really towards the end of my year. But when I realized just on my own that the project will not continue unless you teach and train the locals in that area how to be a part of their own solution and how to fix their own problems, then all you're doing is creating a culture of dependency. And so that would really become... The the methodology for all of our programs around the world, that I don't want to go on anywhere and give people free clean water if in the end they're going to become dependent upon me or mm-hmm. upon the West to provide things for them. In the end, it's much better to use locals to teach and train them to do the work and empower them to be a part of their own solutions so that they're the ones fixing their own problem. And it's not always us coming to their rescue.
Now, let's be clear. You were in Darfur to do good things for people in dire need. And you accomplished that. But you accomplished it against the background of this, I guess it's a civil war. And these rebels, the Janjaweed, who were trying to destroy access to water, even as you were trying to build it. I would think if the people of Darfur were a target, you certainly had to be. And in fact, you have... I think it's early in the book where you're riding through the desert in a Range Rover, and the way it's written, it's right out of an Indiana Jones movie with people shooting at you and you laughing. Tell the story.
Yeah, it was I would come back from an area called Jebel Marra, which is a United Nations no-go zone. You know, it was deemed too insecure for the UN personnel to work in, and I chose to work in that area for a lot of reasons, but it mainly had the biggest need. And I was coming back from there from an assessment to there had been some cholera outbreaks, and I was coming back, and I'd driven the road back in there back and forth there quite a few times, and there was this one area that I would always get through where there's always burnout villages all over the place. There was one where the road went right through this town that was a burnout village, and I noticed something different as I was driving back on this drive, that for once, it wasn't a ghost town. It normally looked like an old West ghost town, kind of. You'd go through and there's no one there. Mm-hmm. But I noticed that there were people kind of up on the hillside, and I thought that was kind of strange. And I kept going on the road, and as I started getting near this little village, I caught that there was a man to the left of me, you know, a few hundred yards up, and he had a traditional, you know, white Arab garb on, and some of the other guys had soldier uniforms on, and this guy's had an AK-47 like many of them do, but it was normally they'll jump out on the road and fire it in the air and have me stop my guys, and sometimes they've stole our stuff or beaten my man or robbed us or whatever, but never have they hidden and then had the barrel of the gun pointed right, you know, at me, and I was driving the lead vehicle. And so I was kind of thinking, do I stop and try to reason with these guys, or, you know, what do I do? And mm-hmm. as I got closer, I realized that these guys aren't wanting to be seen. And so that kind of alarmed me a little bit. And instead of slowing down, I just stepped on the gas. And right when I hit that gas pedal, the first guy shot his machine gun. And that first bullet, I don't know if it went too, if it led me too much or was too far behind, but it missed. And then I noticed, you know, another three guys on the left side of the road, and then another four guys on the right, you know, seven or eight guys in total, and they all started shooting at my Land Cruiser and the one behind me, and I remember hearing the what it sounded like with bullets, you know, ripping through the side of the sheet metal of the car and clanging around and, you know, and smashing glass, and you know, people always ask, are you afraid when things like that happen, or when, you know. And I think in those situations, you don't have time to think and to be afraid. You just kind of react off adrenaline. And normally, and for me, anytime I'm uncomfortable or you know, if I'm in a situation when I'm uncomfortable, sometimes I just start laughing, you know. And so I think I started laughing. But what I was laughing at, too, because I was, for some reason, I immediately thought, I think me and the guys back in the compound had just watched Saving Private Ryan. And I remember that scene on the beach where they were coming off the beach and there was all these bullets whizzing by. You can hear the and the clang, clang, you know, going off the metal. And I remember sitting there thinking, this sounds exactly like Steven Spielberg got this right on, man. Like, this sounds just like it. You know, I remember kind of laughing at that. But it definitely wasn't a funny thing. But, I was a bit uncomfortable and didn't know what else to do.
And after evading these people, you say you asked yourself a question that you'd asked many times before. What the hell is a guy like me doing in the Sudanese desert getting shot out in the middle of the largest humanitarian crisis of our lifetime? Why, indeed, there are plenty of safer places that need water. Why there? Why? And once that happened the first time, why wouldn't you just pack up and go?
I'm kind of stubborn, I guess. So, you know, I wanted to go there in the beginning because it was the place that was in the most need. And as it got more difficult, I mean, to be honest with you, after my six-month mark, this was before I'd been ambushed, but I'd already had my guys hijacked once on that same road by the same guys. And they beat one of my men to, you know, pretty bad. And I had one of my other drivers almost beaten to death. And I was very close to calling it quits after my six-month mark, you know. It was tough for me to make the decision. I'd had a rest and relaxation R&R break at 6 months, and it was hard for me to make the decision to come back and get back into that. But I'm stubborn, I think. And also, even though something's hard, when I start something, I want to finish what I set out to do. And I'd set out to at least be there for a year. And so even no matter how hard it is, if I start something, I've always been taught that you finish it.
Well, you went to areas that the UN wouldn't go to, the so-called no-go zones. I mean, if it was dangerous, too dangerous for them to go, and they have training. You had no training in this kind of activity. So why wasn't it too dangerous for you to go? Why didn't it cross your mind that, you know, maybe there's a reason this is a no-go zone?
It definitely crossed my mind. And whenever I would go into the UN security meetings, they would always report on incidents of violence, and they would always come from these areas. But the reason why they were coming from these areas is because they were held by the rebels, the guys that were fighting against the government, saying that we're not going to allow you to continue to kill and rape our women and children, and we're going to fight back. And so they held these areas. But because they held these areas, the government wouldn't allow supplies to get to them. And the UN, because of the constant fighting, saw that it was too dangerous. And so I chose to be in those areas because they were the most need, but also because I guess I kind of wanted to be behind those guys.
Doc Hendley, our guest. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Doc Hendley. Wine to Water is the name of the 501c3 organization that he founded several years ago up in the Raleigh area, which has now become, a much bigger organization, a worldwide organization in some cases. And he's written a book about his quest to bring water to those who need it most. Wine to Water, a bartender's quest to bring clean water to the world. You've gone to Darfur, as well as to other places in Sudan, to Uganda, India, Cambodia, elsewhere. Have you been to all these places, or do you have people now who go for you?
Almost. We're in, we're in 12 different countries now, and I've been to probably 10 of them. I'd say India and Sri Lanka are the ones where we were using partners on the ground that were already there to just accomplish the work. I didn't need to buy the plane ticket to go. You know, I knew the people really well that were already there and can trust them to see the project through that we were trying to do. But everywhere else, I've had the luxury to go and see and experience these people's culture and lives and build relationships with them. But also see that the water problem, even though almost every developing country has a water problem, it's different in every country. And the needs are different, and the answer to that same problem is different depending on the country that you're in. And so it's been really fun to really spread my wings and learn the different aspects of the water crisis around the world.
Do you know going in what the problems are, or do you find them out once you get there?
A lot of times you kind of got to fly by the seat of your pants. You know, you something that you think for sure is going to work because it worked in this area is just not going to work in a different area. Whether it could be something as simple as the local people don't really like this style of filter that you want to start making and let them use, or they don't even like the way the water tastes anymore after you've cleaned it because they like the brown chocolate milk looking water and the way that tastes, you know. And so you got to always get around those kind of things. And,
wow.
You know, we have a filter in Uganda where the people, if you give them crystal clear water out of a ceramic style filter that we use in Haiti, they're not going to continue to drink it because they're used to drinking this water that has taste. Well, and so we use a biosand filter that it still cleans the water, but it still retains the smell and the taste of the water that it was before. So
what does
it taste
like? Take
those things into account.
What does it taste like to you?
To me, it tastes like chalk. I'll tell you, every time I've drink, this is why I don't really have a lot of people travel with me. I've only done it like once or twice, because everything that they tell you not to do when you travel, I do it all. You know, I drink the local water, I eat the local food, I do everything. And a lot of times it's out of disrespect. If I've realized that this old lady has walked 4 hours to get me water, and you know she's bringing me a bowl of water as a sign of you know welcome to my hut, you know, mm-hmm. I'm going to drink it, and it always tastes like chalk or dirt to me.
Mm. How do you explain you're not getting sick? Because there are native parasites that people build up immunities to that you don't have an immunity to. How do you explain that?
Oh, I get so sick. I've gotten every time I go, I get sick. I've had any type of giardia, any type of worm and parasite you could think of. I always bring medication with me and just I plan on getting sick. And I guess I haven't really gotten immune to any of the things that they've gotten immune to, but I guess I've just gotten used to being sick. So I just work through, you know, anything and everything you can think of. And I've had malaria. I've had typhoid. I've had it all. But
do they don't understand the concept of bacteria and parasites, do they, in many cases? Do you when you explain it to them, do they understand it?
Yeah, a lot of these areas, especially the more, you know, out there tribal areas, it's very hard to help them to understand the need for cleanliness and hygiene, and because that all kind of goes hand in hand with clean water. Mm-hmm. And so what we do with the women in the community, a lot of times in these areas, we always tag in these hygiene promotion and education programs. And what we found out is even if you give them crystal clear, clean water right in the middle of their village, you can decrease diarrheal disease by 40% in the children. But if you also tag along with it a hygiene education program and you're teaching the mothers better hand washing techniques and skills for taking care of their children's cleanliness and washing the food and washing the containers that carry their water, you can double that diarrheal disease decrease to 80%. So we always try to do that. And again, that's all that is just education. It's just teaching them this is why your child get sick. This is why a lot of the children in the village haven't made it to their fifth birthday. Mm. It's not because of some evil spirit or voodoo. It's because of these things that are in water that are on our hands that we need to clean.
Well, that's a whole new way of thinking and one that took the Western world a long time to come to grips with. So how quickly do they embrace that?
I think a lot of times for them, it really all it just takes is just physical evidence. Like, after you get them to start using in Uganda a BioSim filter and they see after a handful of weeks that their children aren't perpetually sick anymore, mm-hmm. It doesn't take a parent too long to say, when this big concrete box came into my hut after that, my children weren't all the time down with diarrhea and I wasn't sitting here worried if they were going to make it or not. That's all it takes sometimes to show them. The importance and that look, and this is what this thing does. All it does is clean those things that we're telling you about out of the water. And then we use that same concept that you need to use this soap, and with your children, it'll clean those same things off of their hands and their face. So take care of your children and wash them, you know. So after you show them a little bit of that evidence, it's not really hard for them to make that behavior change.
How do you communicate? Do they speak English or do you know the native language in some cases?
In Darfur, I made a really, really strong effort to learn Arabic because I knew I was going to be there for so long. And also that culture really intrigued me, that the Muslim culture. I really fell in love with a lot of my Islamic guys that were working with me and that we worked with.
Because?
What's that?
Because?
I don't really know. I can't put my finger on it. I guess I had such a stigma towards the Nation of Islam per se because of what we see in the media here and how they're negatively portrayed, and because I come from a conservative Christian family in the South, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I meet these guys and I see how, man, my guys were so serving and so good to me and so kind, and I saw them with their children and I would see them pray 5 times a day and they were just so, I don't know, I just really respected them and I try to force any of them to see or believe what I believe. I just respected the way they were and was always honest about my beliefs with them, but I really just fell in love with my team there, my guys, the culture. And so, yeah, I really loved that. I can't remember what the original question was.
Well, the original question was, how do you communicate with them?
Oh, right. So I wanted to learn Arabic at least because I really, you know, love that culture. But a lot of the other areas, I do have a translator, but I still always try to learn a little bit of each language in the area that I am, just because it's just, when you make that effort of trying to speak their language, and they'll kind of laugh and you fumble through some words. But it shows them that you don't feel that you're any better than they are, that, that you're just trying to relate to them. And so that's always important to me, to speak what I can where I'm at.
Yet you talk about, on some of your trips home to the States, you describe yourself as being a wreck. You had trouble settling back into daily life in America. You didn't want to talk to anybody. You retreated from your family. Is that PTSD?
I don't know. I try to think about it. People will always talk about culture shock when you go to a new culture, and I experienced culture shock, you know, for a week or maybe two when I went into Darfur. But then that simple life became my life. It became my culture. It was very simple and easy for me to love and fall into. And then when I came back home that first time, and even the second time after being gone for a year, I don't know what it was, if it was post-traumatic stress or if it was culture shock or whatever, but it's infinitely harder to come home and get used to this culture, because we have so much and we take so much for granted. And it literally, I didn't do well my first couple weeks just on my break. And then when I came home for a year, I don't know if I could have really pulled myself together had I not. I met my wife probably within a week or two after I came home from Darfur for good. And I don't know if I would have pulled it back together and been able to continue growing this organization had I not met her and had her really be patient with me and encourage me and pull me through, you know, believe in me on the days that I didn't want to get out of bed in the morning. And so it is very difficult. And that's one thing I've had to learn how to balance. You know, it's not just Darfur, but when I come back from, let's say, Haiti after the earthquake, and then I get home and, you know, here's a baby in my hands. I got to go change a diaper. And I just got out of, like, one of the most miserable scenes that I've ever been to. And it's been a learning experience, learning how to balance going from these places and coming home. But my family is what helps me do it. They ground me, for sure.
Obviously, these people need help. What you're doing is helping them, obviously. And without you, they would be suffering more than they already are, but we tend to look at these places through a Western lens and feel sorry for them and feel like they're living in this terrible situation of deprivation. And yet, and I've heard this from other people, not just from you, when you go there and you talk to these people, they smile, they have fun, they're happy. They don't see themselves in being in the dire situation that we see, because we know how we live. They don't know how we live. So yeah, how should we feel about them?
That's one of the biggest mistakes that we have, and it's in good intentions. We don't look at the screen and feel sorry for these people, and that's out of bad intentions. We genuinely want to help. But I really would encourage anybody that's got that kind of heart that's like, man, I just want so bad to help these people or whatever. I think the first thing people should do before they just start, I don't know what, you know, digging in and throwing millions of dollars at a problem, I think people should go and see, because I still think they could use help. But I think the way we would approach that help would be totally differently. We would focus more on sustainability and training and education instead of just throwing food and clothes and whatever at them, because we would see that they're not unhappy. And in fact, I would actually argue that they're probably more happy than we are here. They're more content with their lives. They enjoy their lives. I see in the worst slums of Ethiopia, Uganda, you see people that smile and enjoy their life. And when I come home, I see people that are arguing because their phone's a little slow that day, or the internet's slow, or the traffic is bad today. And it just puts it all in perspective for you. Like, we get mad at so many little things that are just stupid.
So the lesson here, I guess, would be that the kind of work that you do, bringing access to water and teaching people how about sanitation and about clean water and about washing so that they decrease the spread of disease, is a good thing as long as we don't impose our way of life on them. Let them take what they need from us and work it into their own lives in their own way.
Yes, of course, and that's really it, and that's why it's so important to use the locals to do that work. So in each country, we basically try to help, if there's not one already established, which a lot of times there already is, but we'll try to help create a little small local nonprofit, or what they're called CBOs, community-based organizations, and then work through them to do all the work so that this, you know, our guys in Cambodia, they're called Kong Kameng, which means for the children. And when I first started working with this guy, there was three guys on his staff, and all he wanted to do was just help the children of his country. And now, after working with him for 3 years, there's 30 people on his staff. We've got two drilling machines now. They're doing all kind of programs helping the children, and it started with water. And we just helped empower this local guy and this local group. They get all the credit for it there locally. We're not going around driving trucks with, you know, putting our name everywhere, because, you know, we want those local Cambodians to look up to their own people and see that they can accomplish great things. And so I think that's really what it's all about, is believing in the people and really allowing them to be a part of their own solution.
We've heard that in the future, wars will be fought over water. And you believe that, too. You point out Sudan and Egypt. Why those areas?
Well, I mean, that's going to be a hot spot, mainly because of the Nile River. Mm-hmm. They're already arguing over how much consumption is being used by Uganda, which is where Uganda and Ethiopia is where the Nile River begins. And then it runs north, and then they're already arguing that Sudan's population in Khartoum is growing too much, and they're using too much water, and so Ethiopia is not getting as much water downstream as, or upstream, for that case, than they were before. And I could definitely see that becoming a hot spot, but I definitely 100% believe that unless we start to do something now, that more wars and more lives will be lost over fighting for water than we ever was for oil.
We have a couple of listeners who wanted to chime in here. On Facebook, David writes, wondered if Doc ever thought of working with the group Charity:Water. Charity Water. Have you? Do you know them?
The Charity Water is absolutely mm-hmm. phenomenal. I know Scott Harrison well. I've gotten to meet with him a few times in New York, and they're similar in aspect where they partner with groups that are already out in the field doing the work to do that. And an absolutely phenomenal guy, Scott, who started the organization, a phenomenal group, and they have done amazing things. Mm-hmm. They got their official start, I believe, in 2007, and they have raised an unbelievable amount of money to fight this water crisis, and my hat goes off to them for sure. So we work very similarly, where we just find partners in the field and begin to support and train and teach them, and so they... Yeah, I absolutely love their work and what they're doing.
And we have an email from Alan who says the American Water Works Association has a similar program called Water for People, run by water mm-hmm. industry professionals. I only have 30 seconds left, but they want to know if you've heard about them or had any interaction with them.
I have. I've got to do a lot with engineers around the country and learning more from here. And all of them talk about Water for People. And that's kind of the engineers' go-to group. And they are also absolutely phenomenal in the work that they do. And we always just try to support. We're all doing this together, and they're also doing a great job.
Doc Henley, who founded Wine to Water, a former bartender in North Carolina, and that organization has grown and grown and helped people all over the world now. His book is called Wine to Water, A Bartender's Quest to Bring Clean Water to the World. We haven't even scratched the surface of this book. It's a really rollicking story, actually, when you come right down to it, and a very interesting one as well. Thank you for the hour. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much, Mike.
You're welcome.